Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the future of flying. Since the start of the pandemic, there have been many things Americans have not been allowed to do. Go to a movie theater, eat in a restaurant, take the kids to a playground. But the airlines have remained open, operating a reduced number of flights with very few passengers. Most of us did not even want to fly or simply didn't need to. But as the country begins to reopen, more people are returning to the skies. So, is it safe to fly? And will the airline industry ever look the way it did before the pandemic? I asked James Fallows these questions. He's national correspondent at The Atlantic and a pilot himself. Jim, things are not looking so good for the airline industry right now. I read that airline travel is down 95%. Is that a true figure?
Yes, it is. And it was actually worse than that right in the start. About 6 weeks ago, it was down by 98%.
Wow.
And there's a wonderful chart, a live chart the TSA maintains of how many people go through their checkpoints every day. And it's back up now to about 9% of what it was a year ago at this time. So still, it's even now with some recovery, it's more than 90% reduced.
So what is going on now? What is travel like? How many planes are actually flying? Are they taking people or are they just flying?
In my life as a reporter, I would love to be able to say, well, I took these last three flights and I can tell you it was like this. I've not been on a commercial air flight since late February when I was moaning and groaning about how crowded it was, you know, how people were packed together like sardines, et cetera. Now, as we mentioned, there are only a handful of flyers traveling. To put it, give it numbers. A year ago, the daily traffic level for the U.S. would have been about 2.5 million people on a normal day. Now it's around 200,000 people. So, you know, less than one tenth as much. And the airlines have reduced their flights dramatically, but not as much as they would do if they were free to cut them all together. And the reason for that is part of there are two non-economic reasons why the airlines are flying a lot of empty or nearly empty flights. One is the bailout package that passed a month or so ago required them to keep service to a number of places they would have just cut off if it were an economic matter. So they'll fly, I think the average passenger load a week or so ago was 10 or 11 people per flight. So if you think these planes can hold 100, 200, they're still flying them because that was the term of the bailout bill. The other is that takeoff and landing slots at airports are the most precious commodity in the whole world of aviation, and you want to kind of hoard them. And so airlines have felt on a use it or lose it basis, they had to establish they were still having slots at National and Dulles in DC, still at LAX, still at O'Hare. So that's why uneconomically and unenvironmentally, there are still empty planes traveling through the sky.
So how would you describe the financial shape the airlines are in?
They're in better shape than 9/11. This is a worse problem for them than 9/11 was, because 9/11, of course, was a sudden shock in every way for the U.S. and a shock especially for the airlines because they were the vehicles of destruction then. We're now a couple of months into this pandemic. Within a couple of months of 9/11, traffic had much more fully returned. And the reason was people had come up with secure cockpit doors and, you know, more screening of people through the various checkpoints. And so there was more of a recovery. So it's a worse shock now. They're in financially better shape because the last few years have been so profitable for them. All the things that passengers have not liked about air travel, the airlines have liked about air travel because they've been able to get sort of war chests. But I think there is, in the sort of air travel professional press, there's widespread supposition that one of the major U.S. airlines is going to have to file for bankruptcy. People disagree about which one it might be, but the candidates are Delta, United, American, and Southwest. There's been so much consolidation that those are the four big carriers now. There's a lot of smaller ones too, but it's a time that it's not sustainable on its current level.
So money from the stimulus package has been going to the airlines and has kept them afloat as long as they continued to fly to these places that were deemed absolutely necessary.
Yes, and as long as they keep very substantial part of their previous staff on board. So you'll have a plane taking off with, let's say, 6 or 8 passengers and a full or nearly full crew of flight attendants and, of course, pilots and first officers there. A number of pilots I've spoken with, because there are still many fewer flights than before, a lot of pilots are just furloughed. They're still being paid, but they're not flying, which is going to create its own complication pretty soon because they need to get retrained. You have to fly all the time to be certified as a pilot, and they're not flying now.
So are we talking about one big airline that's going to go down? What about the commuter flights? What about the smaller ones?
I think we're talking about a whole economic system that's going to be in really significant trouble. Because think about all the air travel that so many people did. And I can say most of us, because in the last couple of years, most Americans have taken an airline flight within the past year. That wasn't the case 20 or 30 years ago. Airlines used to be much more expensive. They're much more, they can be very cheap now, or they were until recently. And so most people have flown. And we, think of all the businesses related to that. However you get to the airport, whether it's a taxi or an Uber or a Washington Flyer or whatever, you park at the airport. There's some kind of fee there. There are things you buy at the airport. There are hotels at the airport. There are restaurants. There are all these other things. And the rental car system when you get to the other side, and just all the other, a surprisingly large part of the American economy has been tied to very frequent air travel. So I think we're talking about that whole economic system: hotels, restaurants, rental cars. The Hertz company has filed for bankruptcy,
yes,
as you recall. And so the airlines, they're in a weird time warp compared with other industries, where on the one hand, they do things minute by minute. If you're shopping for prices, the prices can go up or down by the minute, depending on what their load factor is. On the other hand, it takes Boeing or Airbus 20 years to plan a new airliner. And it takes the big airlines years to say, okay, we're going to need this many planes in the future. So I think airlines and all the associated part of the industry are thinking this is going to be a significant multi-year change for them.
Interesting that Boeing announced it was laying off a great number of people and going to concentrate on going back to that plane that seems to have so many flaws to it, and there were 2 major crashes.
Yes, this Boeing 737 MAX, which has its own drama, as I know you've covered over the months, is, if it weren't for everything else going on, that would, of course, be the main story in aviation right now. And I think people would have expected that by now, the various fixes and repairs, which are a complicated matter of software and hardware and training and all the other complexities of the ecosystem, the airline ecosystem, they would have been resolved about now. And Boeing is trying to concentrate on that. An interesting thing about the 737 MAX is we recall those 2 horrific crashes in Southeast Asia and in Africa now about a year and a half ago. Even if you allow for those crashes and all the people who died, commercial air travel has been safer than ever before in history over the last couple of years, over the last 5 years. And so you have a system that has evolved to become safe, notwithstanding these 2 horrible disasters. And they're trying now to adjust to the loss of economic demand without cutting corners on safety, which of course they can't do.
But laying off thousands of people as well?
That is a surprisingly precedented part of Boeing's history. You know, we think of Boeing is year in and year out the leading American exporter. You know, these Boeing planes go all around the world. It's America's leading manufacturer. But over a 20 or 30 year history, Boeing's employment level has constantly gone up and down because the airline industry is cyclical. So after 9/11, there were layoffs. After the 2008 financial crash, the airline industry was going into recession for a while. So people in the airline industry are, that's probably the least shocking part. What's gone on, because Boeing more than Airbus has recognized that its workforce has gone up and down as the demand for these planes has gone up and down too.
So you mentioned that one of the major airlines is probably going to go down. Which airline do you believe is going to be able to step in and take advantage of that failure?
You know, that's such an interesting question. And I've been asking some of my airline experts that, and people have a million, it's sort of like sports talk radio, where you say, well, you know, if the Cowboys traded this person at tight end, what will they do? And I think nobody has a clear answer. The interesting way to think about it, and of course, we're talking about, you know, consequences to be very harmful for many people, but just as a organizational matter, the airlines have very different structures. Those of us in DC, as you and I are right now, know that United has a very strong route presence in DC and in Newark from taking over Continental, and in Houston and in San Francisco and in LAX and in Denver and Seattle. Those are the main United places. So their routes all radiate from there. American, which is another, you know, I think it's by many measures the largest airline, Dallas is its hub, and it has other, Chicago, Miami are places where it has very strong presence. Southwest has a distinctly non-hub operation where it's point-to-point flights from San Jose to Burbank. I think they go to Burbank, and BWI to wherever. You know, it has avoided the hub and spoke. And of course, Delta is the other one of these big four, which took over Northwest long ago. So you have Atlanta as one of its hubs, and Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Salt Lake City. And so whatever is the, however things are reconfigured, there will be some reshuffling of the cards, and the hub and spoke travel that we're all accustomed to, depending on which airline is our main carrier, will be somehow refactored. So I think that the route structure will look different a couple of years from now, depending on how many people travel then, what companies are around, and what the new traffic flow seems to be.
So if I'm thinking about traveling right now, which I'm not, but if I am, what are ticket prices going to be like?
Ticket prices can either be episodically very low or not as low as you might think. And the reason for that is episodically very low. We've seen emails saying, you know, $99 coast to coast or $49 to go from DC to Atlanta or something like that. Interestingly, one of the airline experts I talked with about this about 2 weeks ago was saying that if you book on those flights, often they will get canceled at the last minute. And the reason is the airlines are seeing if they can put together a flight, and it may not be worth it, or they'll consolidate it. The other flights will be more similar in their pricing to normal times. And the reason is this. The airlines, as we mentioned before, are experts at changing everything minute by minute to maximize load factor, to make sure that every single seat on that plane is filled, because that's how they make their money. The plane's going to go anyway. The pilot's going to be paid anyway. The cabin crew is going to be paid anyway. They might as well get every single seat filled. And so there would be these sort of last minute bargains you might get. What's interesting now is the airlines realize that price is not what's keeping people from flying. There is basically no price at which it might be worth your while to go right now from National Airport to Atlanta or to some other place, especially if you're feeling sick or if you're feeling vulnerable or if there's sickness someplace. And so there's no point in reducing the price. It's not going to get more traffic coming in. So I think that next year, when there's something more like normal traffic, the airlines might think price cuts are more valuable. Right now, there's no point in cutting prices because you're not going to get more people.
What would this, obviously a hypothetical flight on my part, what would the experience be like at the airport, getting on the plane, sitting, waiting? What would it be like?
Well, conveniently enough, I just got a guide booklet put out by Airbus of how they're planning for their people, both in Europe and North America, to reconfigure the flight experience. And I will even call this up in front of me so I can go through. They're having the six stages of travel, where they say things will be changed. The booking phase, which in a way we've talked about with the ticket prices not going down that far, getting to the airport, being in the airport, being on the flight, getting off the plane, and then other dealings with the airport. And so the main thing they're putting out is sort of a combination of what you could think of as public health theater. You remember security theater after 9/11. We're doing things that would make people feel safe, even if they had only a sort of tangential relationship to actually being safe. And the idea is there'll be a fair amount of public health theater, of people ostentatiously with gloves and with all the other ways to demonstrate they're being careful. And then real ways to sort of space out the passengers, sanitize people. Getting to the airport is sort of a you're on your own situation. You have to find out, are you going to take a taxi or Uber or Lyft to get there? And how do you think about doing that? Will a family member drop you off? Once you get into the airport, I think we're going to see within a few months something that has been commonplace in China for a long time. It has been 15 plus years since China had its SARS outbreak, of course. And since then, anybody who's traveled to or within China is familiar with going through a gate which takes your temperature. It's sort of like the metal detectors that we have in so many public buildings in the U.S. These are temperature detectors, and it's a big gate you walk through, and they have away these heat cams that can look at each person's face coming in and see what your heat is. And if you are looking too hot in a temperature sense, they will pull you aside and they'll have another little temperature gun. They'll point at your forehead for infrared detection. And then if you seem to have a fever, they won't let you get on the plane. And so something like this, I think, will be part of our experience, not next week or not next month, but I would bet next year. Interestingly, I think the FAA is going to have to mandate this because it will be expensive for airports. It will be another thing that slows things up. So you'll have a way to be screened for temperature the way you're now screened for other kinds of security. There will be, at the check-in, probably there will be contactless. It'll do everything possible to have, you know, plexiglass screens when you're checking in, getting rid of paper tickets to the greatest degree possible. I like printing out my ticket because I like being able to hold it and not have the phone conk out, but there will be those changes. TSA will be slower because they'll have to have more separation among people. The bins will probably be wiped down. It may be faster in one way. There'll probably be more limits on carry-on bags. And the reason is that bags you take onto the plane, that's just extra germ stuff that can be transmitted to other people. So you'll check more of your bags. Going through TSA, it will be slower. There'll be more separation when you get to the gate. They'll probably have those, you know, those barriers. It probably, the FAA will need to require masks. And I say the FAA because if airlines try to do it themselves, they're going to get all sort of the pushback that we know about from other aspects of life now. And it's easy for, they can say the FAA requires just as they do with 3 ounces of liquid and just as they do with seats in the full upright position. So then you'll get on the plane and there will be, probably they will start boarding from the back, just to avoid the churn, you know, boarding in ways that minimize the churn of people passing over each other. So boarding window seats and from the back, and probably for the foreseeable future, having the center seats vacant. A reason for that is just they don't have as enough people to fill them up. Now, we've seen a few flights that do have enough people, but those seem to be the anomalies. Two other, a couple of other in-flight things. there'll be no blankets or pillows for the foreseeable time. Somebody made the grim comment, think of blankets as vectors of disease in American history. they have an unhealthy reputation and pillows. No paper magazines, more things to transmit germs, even though it doesn't last very long on paper. Very little in-flight service, even compared to what was there before. And there may be less Wi-Fi. The reason is Wi-Fi has never been a profitable business for the airlines. And so it's already operating a loss. And so it's one more way they can cut costs. Then you get to the other side, you get the bags out. So it just will be more like other things we've experienced, I think, until there is a vaccine.
Let me ask you about masks and the FAA. Some airlines are currently requiring masks, but why does the FAA have to get into it?
The airlines never want to be in the position of competing on safety. So it's an extremely regulated business. Everything from how many hours of duty time versus rest time pilots and crew have, how often everything has to be inspected. We've all had the experience of flights being canceled because the crew has timed out or because there's a certain kind of minor part that's not showing in spec, and it would have no real effect on safety, but they are required, not to take off, or they can't have these checklists. And so I think the airlines come from a culture where they don't want one to be competing with the other on how lax their rules are. So I think the reason the FAA hasn't gotten to this yet is there's so few people on the airlines, the traffic. But I expect in a prediction sense, and I want in a citizen sense, the FAA to make these requirements, because then the airlines can do it. But if they have to be the one, okay, you go first, it's not going to happen. So I think they all would like the FAA to require it.
What about telling a passenger who does test positive for a high temperature, you're not going to fly? Who says that the airline can do that?
The airlines have absolute jurisdiction, even including the pilot and the first officer have absolute personal discretion to say they don't want to take off the plane. And we've seen some examples of that have been abused in the last 10 or 15 years of a flight crew saying, we're uncomfortable with this kind of passenger. This person is dressed in a certain way we don't like. So the airlines as companies and the flight crew as individuals have absolute control. They are the captain of the ship. They can say, I don't want to take off. So I think that if there is somebody who is obviously sweating and sick and having a high temperature, the airlines can say, we'd rather have you not go on this flight. Again, this is something that is much better handled by a consistent rule. So the airlines, which are desperate for money and are thinking of repeat business and don't want to make enemies any more than they need to, won't say, okay, we think you're sick. And you can imagine the videoed scenes of outraged customers saying, oh no, I'm fine, your equipment. So this is a case where the airline industry would be in favor of regulation because they can all do it if they all have to do it. But if they don't all have to do it, then they won't do it individually.
More of my conversation with James Fallows coming up.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. So, Jim, what about returning to some kind of normalcy? When do you see that happening, and what would a new normal look like?
I've been asking people in the business, pilots, flight crew people, you know, airplane company people from Boeing and Airbus and others, and nobody knows. The most common answer is when there is a vaccine, then things can return to some kind of a normal. And that's a proxy for when people feel safe again about all the unwanted intimate connections you have going on an airplane, at the airport, in the lines and all of that. And so, but it's also, that is also a proxy for when there is a vaccine and there's no longer a safety concern on people's minds about flying as much as they used to, will the need to travel seem as pressing as it has in the last couple of years? Most people think that it will return to some kind of normal for these reasons. That, again, last year, if it was about 2.5 million people per day who were taking airline trips in the U.S., some of that was business, and especially the expensive travel was business. The people in the front of the plane who make all the profit for the airlines, they're almost all either business travelers or just people who are rich. But the volume, especially for Southwest and for the discount airlines, is people who are going on vacations, or they're seeing their relatives, or they want to go to Europe. And again, most Americans now take an airline trip sometime in the year. And so you can imagine, if it is safe and if there are things put in place so you feel, okay, we can take our grandchildren to Europe, or we can go see our relatives and they're sick, or whatever else, people think that there will be some rebound to something like what the previous level was. Again, it's 2.5 million per day last year versus 200,000 per day now. And that's the, we'll see where within that range it recovers to.
And in fact, travel to Europe right now, my goodness, where is that? I would think it's pretty well bottomed out.
Yes, it has been affected even more than domestic travel in the U.S. Again, domestic travel in the U.S. went down at its worst by 98%, and now it's down to just about down 90%. The travel to Europe, between North America and Europe, is still in the mid-90s in its decline level, and partly that's because of an issue that doesn't affect U.S. travel, which is the quarantine question. You know, a lot of countries are now saying, sure, you can come here, but you got to be locked up for 2 weeks. And if you come back to the U.S., so you would do that if you had to. But across international borders now, quarantines and the ways in which they can be imposed at the last minute, again, mean that people are only doing this kind of travel if they feel they have to. And that'll take a long time to rebound.
You know, it strikes me that what you and I are doing right now, that is Zooming for this conversation, is sort of revolutionizing the way people think about whether they have to travel or not. Do you think that that's going to continue to change people's thoughts about, well, do I really need to make this trip?
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. I'm sure it will have profound and complicated effects. There's some kinds of things that you can already foresee are just going to be permanently different. For example, my magazine, The Atlantic, as of 3 months ago, there were a couple hundred people every day in its offices in the Watergate, and almost 100 people in its offices in New York. Those offices are closed now, and there are team meetings once a week where everybody, all, you know, hundreds of people are on a Zoom call and smaller team meetings all the time. And I'm sure there will be a much different rhythm of people who feel they have to go to the office. For other kinds of travel, I can imagine that some big gatherings, people can feel that it's just different to have a gathering of 300 people on Zoom versus seeing those people and having a meal with them and talking with them in the corridor. So I think some kinds of in-person gatherings will people say, yes, we see why it actually is different to see people in person rather than on Zoom. But I think a lot of other things, there'll be a different travel sensibility 2 or 3 years from now than there was a year ago.
So when you think about people thinking there's a vaccine or there is a preventive measure, do you think that travel will get back up to the numbers it was previously?
I think most people in the business feel that in the medium to long term, let's say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, so much is unpredictable then. Who knows what new diseases will be around? Who knows what environmental regulations will be in place? Who knows what the economic situation will be? Most people feel that in that longer run, there will be some return to almost comparable travel, which again, we're down to one-tenth of what it was last year. If the new normal is 70% of what it was last year, 80 or 90%, I think people feel that when public health concerns go away and people think that person-to-person contact is part of their life again, and tourism and family connections, that somewhere between like 70% of last year's level and 90 or 100% of last year's level might return to. Over the decades, air travel has always gone up despite the episodic downs. And so I think the assumption is at some point it will return, and whether that's 5 years from now, 10 years from now, or never, we'll see.
What about air quality on planes?
Of the things to worry about, this is one I personally don't worry about, and I have an actual reason for that, which is that partly it's the people will be wearing masks, and I think that that will be required. But also the air on an airplane is better handled than most of the other air you encounter in indoor spaces. You know, the new science, as you well know, suggests that it's sustained person-to-person contact is the real problem in a restaurant, in a meeting room, at a cocktail party, at a convention or something. In an airplane, even though you're sitting right next to somebody, and now we're going to assume for a while there will be a middle seat vacant and you'll have masks on, the air on an airplane is constantly recirculated in a circular fashion, where if you're in the window seat, the air is always kind of making a donut shape around you and the person next to you. It's not going front to back in the plane. And every 2 or 3 minutes, it's entirely replaced with air from outside the plane, which doesn't have the virus because it's so cold and pure, and it's going through filters that should remove the viruses. So if somebody sneezes on you, that is a problem. People should be wearing masks, but that is relatively, I think that is a much smaller risk than just being in the airport and all the things that come from being with people at the airport.
In the long run, could the airlines benefit in some way from all of this reshaping?
Until, say, 5 years ago, the saying about the airline industry was it was a great industry that on average just never made money, because airlines were always, there would be a crash and people wouldn't fly, and there'd be the jet fuel would go up or whatever. And the concentration of the airlines, which has made them less enjoyable from the passenger perspective, has made them better as a business. And if they become even more concentrated after this, if one of the four big carriers goes away, and if there's more of a rationalization of route structure, and if current rock bottom fuel prices persist, and if the current airline emphasis on increased, ever-increasing fuel efficiency and green operations continues, then you can see that this could be another rationalization period for them. I think we've seen that we miss air travel when it's gone. We complained about it when it was here, but we miss it if we can't do it at all. And I think it is possible this will be another rationalizing means for them, but there's going to be a lot of individual and corporate dislocation on the way to that.
Well, of course, most of our listeners know that you and your wife have flown all over the country in a small plane, which you pilot. So to what extent are you going to continue to use that plane and take yourself wherever you want to go?
I'm going to continue to do it very avidly. And right at this moment as we talk, the plane is in a repair shop outside Dayton, Ohio, being repainted and having some modernized avionics in it. And as soon as I can get a commercial flight to Dayton, so I can get out there and have a couple days of recurrent training and bring the plane back, a little propeller plane, a four-seat propeller plane, bring it back to DC, Deb and I plan to travel again, because it is Of course, there are dangers that come with small plane aviation, but in terms of just health dangers, you're exposed to many fewer people. It's more or less like driving. I think for a different kind of private aviation, that is jets, small jets, for people who are many-fold more prosperous than I am, I think that's there has already been a boom in that kind of travel because it's another way for people of means to escape not just the hassle of the airline system, but the public health risk of the airline system, because they can go without going through TSA crowds, without going through everything else to these private terminals. So already the private jet business is doing okay.
Jim, before we close, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Thanks so much, Diane, for asking. I'll just say one thing. As you know, in the previous times you and I and Deb have talked, our message has been at a time of extreme trouble for national level governance in the United States, there's tremendous health and vitality in many cities and many of the states. I think in a terrible way, the country has seen that in the last 2 or 3 months, where I think we've had a historic failure of governance at the national level. But you've seen from many state governors of Republican and Democratic Party alignment, you know, Mike DeWine in Ohio, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, both Republicans, many Democratic counterparts, for many mayors around the country, from librarians, from school teachers, from religious organizations, from people saying we need to find some way to demonstrate our civic fabric again. So we've had a grim reminder of what we were trying to say, that there is this tension between national level crisis, which the national government needs to deal with, but a reminder of the local level resilience and decency in much of the country that is coming to the fore.
Jim, thank you so much for being with us.
Diane, it's an honor. Thank you so much.
That was James Fallows. He's national correspondent at The Atlantic. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to me to let me know what you want me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. And as the country does begin to open up, I hope you will stay well and stay safe. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reed.